Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy Connecting the Light. My guest today is John Robinson. He is a clinical psychologist and an ordained interfaith minister, and he believes that he can see heaven on earth, and this has been with him since he was a child. As a result of this, he's recently brought out a book called Finding Heaven Here, which is available from obooks.com, and we shall talk about that. Hello, John, are you there?
I am here, thank you.
Very nice to have you on the program. Since I mentioned that this, shall we call it ability or gift, has been with you since a child, when was it that you first realized that perhaps you were experiencing things a little bit differently to the way other people were?
Surely. When I was a little kid, and I think this is not uncommon, many of us have had this experience, you know, of living in this sort of a consciousness where everything is magical and beautiful and awesome. And then you come back into the family and you see your parents fighting, or one of the kids is complaining or there's a problem. And you want to tell them, oh, wait, you don't need to be like this. Look around you. It's so beautiful. It's so astoundingly peaceful here. And then you try to say it to them, and you get glassy stares or lectures, and then you realize you're off the page, or they're on a different page. And so much of my life has been really about having that, losing trust or belief in it. Not that I didn't stop seeing it, but I kept thinking, well, this can't be right. You know, everybody else says the world is a grim and gloomy place. It's hardship and struggle and suffering. So, you know, I bought into that. Probably the reason I went into psychology is I thought, well, you know, this is where you find the answers. And I found a lot of answers, but I kept coming back to this original perception of the beautiful, shining world, and it never left. I came to realize that we leave it. It doesn't leave us.
Yeah. Do you think, in a manner of speaking, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and you saw that because you were looking for the beauty, whereas some people don't?
Yes. I think anything that you look at with beauty and love and intense consciousness becomes something far more amazing than anything you could think about. And it's always here, always before us.
Yeah, because I think you've described it, this beauty, as radiant and also as if lit from within.
Yes, it's almost like a stained glass window where the light seems to be coming from inside or from the other side, shining through. And in that consciousness, things are extraordinarily beautiful. I mean, things are bright. It's as if someone turned up the color and intensity settings on the computer screen, you know, or the TV screen. Things become amazing.
Yes. I'm sure somewhere in your travels, since you've investigated other religions and you've read about mystics, or perhaps you've even met some, the idea that we all carry energy with us, which sometimes is referred to as the aura, might suggest that what people pick up from each other is this energy that we're giving out. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I think so. I think clairvoyant or you know, psychic have a capacity to see this kind of energy shining in people. And I think in my experience of heaven on earth, people just glow. I mean, as if they're already angels shining from around and from within, and you just see how extraordinarily beautiful everybody is. The whole the cosmetics industry, I think, would fade away if we all saw heaven on earth.
Oh, they wouldn't like that.
They wouldn't like that.
No. Now, in your years of investigating this subject, were you particularly influenced by any particular religion or perhaps mystic?
Oh, which mystics? Well, you know, I don't know, because what I found what was so interesting was that they all are saying the same thing, except perhaps with a different language because they come from different parts of the world. But whether it's Jesus or Joseph Campbell or Thich Nhat Hanh or Eckhart Tolle, they're all saying the same kind of thing. Some of the ones that had impressed me, you know, the most, for example, were the Hindus, the Ramana Maharshi and the Buddhist, Thich Nhat Hanh. And you wouldn't think a Buddhist would be talking about heaven on earth, but there he is saying it. He says, in effect, there's not one day that I do not walk in the kingdom of God. And that's the Buddhist,
right,
who's not supposed to believe in God. I think when we get to the mystics, belief systems become much less relevant than the direct perception of the divine reality.
Hmm. Do you think that anyone can take some form of training or exercises which you teach to heighten their awareness?
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole reason I did the book, because I knew that I wasn't alone. You know, we all see heaven on earth periodically throughout our life, when we're perhaps when we're extraordinarily happy or something really great has taken place, or when we're in love. And suddenly the world is brighter and you're happy and everything is just the way it's supposed to be. Problem is, we just write that off as saying, well, you know, I was just in love and then she dumped me and then it went away. The fact is that you were actually there, and then you closed down your consciousness and reinstated the same old negative beliefs and then lost it again. But the skills I teach in Finding Heaven Here are really all about waking up and seeing where we are for the first time again and again.
Yes. Do you think that what you call heaven around us is actually, perhaps even if we don't know the reason, is seeing God's hand in creation, the beauty of it or the perfection?
Yes. You know, the mystics really tell us that this world is the divine in form, in substance, so that when we look deeply into anything past our concepts, erasing our concepts and seeing it simply as it is in wide awake consciousness, we are looking into God. And that's heaven on earth. It's the divine world everywhere. It's, you know, for years the Western religions have said this is pantheism and we shouldn't allow it and it's some form of, you know, evil, but it's not. I mean, the real truth is that allowed them to stay in power, because if you could see it directly for yourself, you didn't need them. You're already living in creation.
Right.
And the sad idea that we have been expelled from the garden is a wrong interpretation of the Genesis myth. The myth really says that when we ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that is, when we learned to see the world dualistically, as it is, and with our thoughts about it, then we lost heaven on earth. We lost it because we got so enamored in our thoughts that we no longer were able to stop and see. But that's not because any angry God kicked us out. It's because we left it of our own accord and forgot.
Yes, yes. I think there's often a reference to it in a way to talk of it as being a separation.
Yes.
Now, through what you do, and I believe it would be correct to term it, you're trying to wake people up and enable them, I suppose, to have a shift of consciousness.
Yes.
Now, how do you approach that, and can you give us an idea at least of what type of exercises you give people?
Well, let me give you, first of all, maybe an analogy, and then I'll tell you what a key exercise might be. The analogy is that we live in a world where we're going so fast and we're living in a kind of a virtual world of our mind that we really don't see anything. It's like driving down the highway 80 miles an hour, you know, with bugs splattered on the windshield. You only see what you're thinking, and then you're only thinking about what, you know, the crummy things that happened to you today. If you slow down, if you take the top down, you see more. If you stop the car, you see even more. When you get out of the car and start walking into the woods, you see more, and then you smell it, and then you feel it, and you take your shoes off, and the earth's warmth comes in through your soles of your feet, and you're beginning to move from this conceptual, dark, you know, grim place to the natural and extraordinary beauty that exists in the world. That's what's called nature mysticism. I think so many of us like to go out into nature, not just to catch fish, you know, but to be alone with the splendor and wonder of being. So that's the analogy. And the tools are really this. There are several steps. And the more you master them, the more you see. The first step is to stop thinking. Now, we all know how to do that. You know, if you're walking on a balance beam or painting trim on your wall or something, you're not thinking about your taxes. You're literally focused on exactly what you're doing. So it's that kind of non-thinking focus. And then if you heighten that, intensify it as if there was an alarm ringing some place in the outside of the building, you're wondering if there's a fire. You don't start thinking about stuff. You really tune up your senses. Third step is to then start looking at the world exactly the way it is, whether it's a pencil or the table or the amazing color and texture of your own skin. And the more you look at it, and the more you move it around and you see the way the light plays on it, you notice that it has got qualities of depth and beauty that you otherwise normally ignore. And then the next step is to move into the actual presence itself, presence with a capital P, meaning the, you know, the presence of the divine consciousness. And when we learn how to experience consciousness, our own consciousness is in fact part of the divine consciousness. So when we begin to focus on consciousness itself, looking at this hand or this table, things begin to change in extraordinary ways, because in God's presence, the world is transfigured back into Eden, into creation again. Now, the problem is we immediately start thinking about this or wonder if we really can believe what we're seeing, and then we start talking about it, and of course it's gone, and then we convince ourselves it never was there. The whole art is to not think and to move from conception to perception and look intently in God's presence. Then you see this world is, in fact, still the garden.
Yes. When you're talking about stop thinking, in the process of trying to raise your consciousness, would you then encourage people to take up certain forms of meditation?
I think meditation is a very interesting technique, especially because, as Buddha says, these 2,500 years ago, the Buddha said, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. When you sit in meditation and these thoughts keep coming up about the fight you had with your coworker or the wish you had for a new car or these images of whatever, you have firsthand evidence of how you are constantly creating a world that's not there. Because when you open your eyes, you're not seeing your coworker, you're not seeing anything else, you're just seeing what is. But we're always living in this other imaginary world we create. So meditation is an incredible tool for watching how we do that. We dream the world, a world that's not the same as what is.
So
any other forms of meditation or dance or that allow you to get out of your head are useful in the same regard.
Yeah. I should think it's very difficult, and you are practicing your beliefs in this way, to get people to take an interest in doing what you obviously believe is very valuable where their consciousness is concerned, because people tend to stay in a rut, do they?
Yeah.
They're happy with what they know, and they don't like something perhaps that's quite different to upset the balance, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. I saw some research recently that said people are much happier with certainty than they are with truth. In other words, as long as they can say, oh, this is what it is, whether it's a belief system or a religious philosophy or whatever, then they can let go and think that everything's okay, but they're still not seeing anything. You're right. Belief is one of the biggest obstacles to seeing the divine world, because we want to see what we want to start thinking about it, and then that always creates duality.
Yes. And that is indeed what we're living through at the moment, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, we create a world with our thoughts around the globe that is horrible, filled with people we call terrorists and places we call wars, and we believe that the only way to handle things is by bombing them. You know, these belief systems are damaging the world and each other and God.
Yes, indeed. It's interesting that you should make that point, because for many years I've often wondered why you have your representatives in the government, but you rarely hear anyone talking about making peace with other countries.
Yeah.
It's always this attitude of put them down, control them, or make war with them. It's strange, isn't it, that people
It's really our canine or mammal nature's coming up. I have a dog that every time somebody comes to the door or to the fence, she goes nuts. And of course, if you open the gate, she just runs the other way. But she loves this, I'm going to get mad and bark at you thing. And that's what we do as adults.
Yeah.
And then we
yeah.
justify it.
I think what it is, John, we've been conditioned for so long, I think we forget the whole alternatives in life.
We do forget so much. And in fact, it's not so much about remembering and forgetting, it's just about seeing. When we look at, you know, that's what's so wonderful about bringing your supposed enemies to a picnic with you, with their kids and wives. After the afternoon of playing shuffleboard or bocce ball, whatever you do, and having lunch and laughing, you realize that there are no enemies. That we create enemies with our stereotypes and in the way we hurt people.
Yes, yes. Well, you talk of practicing unconditional love, and I should think the hardest thing about that is to love your enemies.
Yes. Yeah. That's why we have to love them in person and as real people, not as our belief systems about their belief systems.
Yes, yes.
Because that always justifies, you know, another bomb.
Absolutely, yes. Nevertheless, because I follow a spiritual path, and you obviously do, I do feel at the moment there is a change in consciousness taking place, and people are registering these energetic changes and feel that there is something great coming along. Have you got the same sort of feeling?
Yes, I agree with that. I think there's a wonderful kind of blossoming of a new consciousness in the world, and perhaps it takes a certain breakdown of the global systems for us to kind of get that it's not about having more stuff and buying more stuff. It's about community and love and friendship and just being in the world as it is. So I think the young people are reinventing the world, and I think that's why Obama has been such a beacon of hope for everybody, because he's not about the old patriarchy hanging on by its fingernails to the old principles of domination and control and ridicule, but to a much more grassroots, we all matter, and everything matters, and the earth matters. And I think we are just so, I mean, most of us are so excited about the birth of a new kind of understanding and consciousness in the world. And I think that's why the ecology movement has so much to do with heaven on earth. Because as we get deeply into the earth and its processes, we realize we're not separate from it. We are it.
Yes. Obviously, the energy of love is terrifically powerful. Do you think we can use it collectively to change the world?
Yes, I think we can. I think that the work is always on oneself. You know, it's not about fixing other people. It's always about raising your own consciousness and capacity for love and patience so that people can't provoke you. And when they can't provoke you, they get tired of it, and then they begin to wonder what you're all about, and then they see another way of doing things. I think that's what Gandhi understood. That's what Martin Luther King understood. In this unconditional, that's what Jesus understood. In this unconditional love, you know, who are they going to attack? There's nobody to attack.
That's right, yes. Very difficult again, I think, to rise to that challenge, not to respond to these things around you that might otherwise upset you.
Just like my dog, you know.
Right. Your poor dog is getting into trouble here, I can see.
Yeah, I got to make sure she doesn't hear the doorbell while we're talking.
Now, I believe you've spoken about loving yourself. Now, where does that come into it?
Well, I think we have to make a distinction. The self is really a complicated idea because it has actually three or four different versions. There's the true self, which is who we were born to be, you know, the way God made us. And that self is not what we think it is. It's just what it already is. And it's full of, you know, talent and initiative and excitement. And it's got its own nature to live out like a flower. And then there's the false self, which is who I think I am. And that self gets created through elementary school and family and college, and, you know, suddenly you're a good or a bad person with good or bad traits, and you have to try harder, and your resume is always getting longer. And it's always about creating this false image of who you are to impress people. And then there's the ego, the part that, you know, is the I or the me part of the personality that's trying to run the show. The whole task is to let go of the false self by quieting your thought that it's purely a thought or originated entity, letting it go and dropping your consciousness back into who you really are. And that true self is always full of love. And as you bring love to it, as you love yourself, it just opens like a mystical flower, a blossom in creation. And then it gives its gifts to the world, because each of us was born with something infinitely precious to offer each other. And love is what love and safety is what brings it out.
You speak of the key to heaven on earth, and I think you said we've been there many times. Does that mean that you have a belief in reincarnation? I mean, are you speaking of previous lives?
Oh, no, I'm thinking of many times since we were born, you know, right. That we've all, you know, if you're sitting at your desk, for example, on a beautiful sunny day, and you're working at the computer, and then you just stop and you look out the window and you watch the dust motes go and your thoughts stop and everything becomes kind of interesting and you kind of space out. Well, you're right on the threshold of moving into the other world. And that happens all the time, whether it's in lovemaking or playing with our kids, you know, or watching a sunset. We're always on the threshold.
Right, yes.
Now, reincarnation is a whole other topic, and I don't really know what I understand about reincarnation. I'll punt on that one.
Okay. Reincarnation or not, though, do you believe that life is infinite?
Yes. I mean, the mystics tell us that the universe, the cosmos, is conscious and alive and awake and aware and intimate, and it doesn't disappear. I mean, that consciousness is everywhere, and it's eternal. Time is only, you know, a model that the human mind imposes on eternity, and when it's gone, eternity is always here.
Yes, yes, indeed. Now, coming back to your favorite saying here about stop thinking, I believe you may have also expressed that, unless that was me thinking it, of going with the flow. Now, is going with the flow the correct way to look at it?
Yeah, I think it is. Because in the flow, when we drop consciousness into our being, in other words, we become aware just of being itself, the body and the energy of the body, we rest in that energy, things naturally start to happen. You discover that you feel like taking a walk, or you reach out to somebody, or you do something kind, or you find yourself painting. This happens by itself, just as on a wonderful Sunday when you don't have any work to do and it's a beautiful day and the kids are away, you can really just do what makes you happy. That's the flow. It's when we interrupt the flow by telling ourselves, well, we should be, you know, cleaning the backyard instead, or we get a telephone call from somebody that says there are problems at work and you shouldn't be happy, that we then betray ourselves and the joy of being and drop back into that fear-driven world, and then we lose it.
Do you believe, in speaking of heaven on earth, that there is actually a heaven off earth as well?
Oh, yes. I think it's a continuum. I think it's an artificial boundary that we've made that says, well, you know, the heaven's only out there, you know, it can't be here too. I think the same principles and the same processes apply. This world may be a little denser, you know, meaning that it takes a little bit longer for us to understand things than the next world, but I think it's the same, you know, powerful principles of love and manifestation occur in both places. They're just, you know, the same thing.
Yes. Do you have specific feelings about what heaven off earth would be, in the sense that how would it differ to what we experience on earth?
Oh, I think in heaven on earth, the world, I mean, there's a perceptual things. In other words, the world becomes brighter and clearer and more lovely and, you know, just fascinating. But I think there's a sense of safety and holiness and timelessness about life that changes everything. Then there's no place to rush to. And there's nothing to figure out, and there's no need to improve yourself. All those things just fall away. And what you have instead is the kind of a quality of contentment or joy that you want to share. You know, so you want to be with people in loving ways. How differently we would live our lives on earth if we were not coming from a place of chaos and frenzy and fear, but from a place of joy and happiness and radiance and wonder.
Indeed. I mean, I would imagine everybody is seeking that type of life, but perhaps they don't put the effort in to achieve it.
And, you know, the problem is that our culture is one of the biggest barriers to it. The culture says, you know, be careful, it's dangerous, you've been kicked out of the garden, there's terrorists around every corner, and you might lose your job. I mean, there's this drumbeat of fear.
Yes,
in the media, in our own frightened minds, that keep us from ever saying, wait, let's stop, this is it. We already found it. Thank you very much. Be happy.
I would agree about the degree of fear that's generated. It's to do with health as well, with these viruses that are flying around.
Yeah.
How do you put that fear to the back of your mind?
Well, again, when you learn to slow down and do the simple, very simple practices in the book, You begin to be happy, and you really have to choose between love and happiness, or fear and distrust. And as we watch ourselves carefully, we realize, okay, which way is my pendulum swinging, toward love and happiness and generosity and kindness, or to, you know, fear and danger and distrust?
Yeah.
I think this is something that the world just needs to change its attitude on, because instead we just create, look at the movies that are created and the video games. It's all about shooting and killing and bomb. How many people get murdered in every movie in the theater these days? How can you feel safe in a world where that's the imagery that we see?
You've picked on one of my favorite complaints about the media, because there just seems to be a continual emphasis on that type of thing. And you're almost looked upon as being a little bit of a sissy, if that's the right expression, if you like lovely things and beautiful romantic stories that have a happy ending.
I think that sensationalism, shock, terror work, because they so overstimulate the nervous system that you just get gripped by it, and then you get addicted to it, and then you come back for more.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right there. And it is a shame that young people are brought up on these games they play that feed them with that type of entertainment, if you can call it that.
Yeah. I think the video industry actually is a very interesting analogy to the mind, because, you know, the young person or any of us has this choice between sitting in the garden, letting the sunlight touch our skin and watching the butterfly, or turning on the video game and having this, you know, duel to the end with robots from another planet. You know, that's the way the mind works. We can be happy and content and loving, or we can get caught up in our own fear-driven imagery and get spun out on it.
Absolutely.
I'm hoping that young people will begin to see this analogy and realize, whoa, we've created the very problem that's making our world crazy.
Yes. And I think the saddest part of that with these violent games is that I think people become immune to what is taking place. And when it happens in real life, to them, it seems to come over to as a game.
Yes. I really think that's why it's so important for us to see. I mean, my model, which I describe in Finding Heaven here, is not an idealistic Pollyanna model. It doesn't just say there's no pain. Because as a psychologist, I've seen the pain. 30 years I spent in deep psychotherapy with people. I've seen rape victims and murderers and people from all different walks of life. And I know the suffering is there, and I know what they've gone through. But that's not how we have to live. And I think that we really need to start learning from each other that love heals these things, and these games and this kind of violence orientation only perpetuates a cycle of violence that has taken us to the edge.
I think you're absolutely correct. Now, I think somewhere in your statements, or probably in your book, which I obviously haven't read, I think you've mentioned that there are many paths to enlightenment. Now, that presumably comes about through your earlier investigation of the different religions and what the mystics taught. But are there any that talk of a different sort of path to yours and yet reach the same goal?
Well, you know, religion is that's a fascinating phenomenon. I mean, somebody deeply seeking the truth has a profound mystical experience, and this could be Buddha or Muhammad or Jesus or Lao Tzu or any number of other people. And then they have this, or the fellow who's the founder of Sikhism and so forth. It's always that same kind of thing, and then they try to explain this extraordinary realization to other people who don't quite get it, so they have to codify it in words. Three or four generations later, the founder, the originally enlightened person, is gone, and they're still trying to figure out what he said, and it becomes more about the words and the principles and the rules and the practices and the dogma. And generations later, we have something that is disconnected from the original awakened consciousness. And the problem is that all these religions have buried in them some incredibly beautiful insights and paths to the unity of life and to the unity of consciousness. They also have all these other sort of distractions, like, are you sitting properly in meditation, you know, or have you done your practice the right way? And if you haven't, then it's obviously not working for you. You can get so caught up in technique or in the debate about belief that you miss the babies out with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When we wake up again, and the mystics are always really saying this, there comes a time when you have to believe your belief. Beliefs are useful, but they're like the finger pointing to the moon. It's not the moon. You know, this is the finger. You need to leave the belief and come into the radiant world and find out for yourself. And it's always here. It's not nearly as hard as they as people say.
Hmm. You mentioned something that intrigued me. You've spoken about thought forms and how they affect us. Would you believe thought forms actually are?
Are actually what?
What are they? I mean, what do you believe they are?
Oh, I see. Well,
forms.
I think thought is one of the divine attributes. You know, everything is made of the divine, and so this capacity for thought is a part of our own capacity for divinity that's amazing. I mean, when you think of calculus, or when you think the way we understand the way we have created mathematics in such a way that we can guide a spaceship to the moon and back again, it's just astounding. Mm-hmm. So we have got this God-given propensity or intelligence, but the problem is if you put the wrong thoughts in there, like the other people are evildoers and they're trying to destroy our way of life, well, then we start using our intelligence to come up with better ways to eradicate those other people. Then we're using our thoughts in a most destructive way. It's the dark side of this capacity. So thought forms are powerful. They're real. They control what we see and what we believe and how we feel. Every feeling you have, sadness, anger, joy, is the result of a thought form. You know, I'm going to get a raise. Oh boy, I feel happy. You know, this person thinks I'm an idiot. Oh, I'm mad.
Yeah, yeah.
These thought forms are so powerful that they run the world, and that's what waking up is so important. Because basically, much of the time, they create an altered world that is full of messes and problems and conflict.
Hmm. So I believe what you're talking about, by any other name, would be the collective consciousness of mankind, and it does actually mean that if enough people put their mind to it, they could actually change the world for the better.
In an instant, starting this moment.
Hmm.
I love those sort of proposals that that we all stop doing everything for 1 hour at the same time on Earth. You know, and then perhaps and then perhaps we might not be so crazy.
Well, yes, that's very interesting. I mean, just by the way, getting off the subject too much, I don't know if you know that in Great Britain during World War II, they had a period set apart every evening and invited the population to send out certain thoughts at 9 o'clock in the evening. And I often wondered if that really had some effect on keeping the people safe in this country.
That's
what they were trying to do.
Somebody was very intuitive and prescient to do that.
Mm.
It's a wonderful practice.
Yeah. I'm not sure of the name, and it's perhaps not of great consequence, but I think it was Lord Dowding. But be that as it may, anyway. And also, just as a point here, talking about thought forms, I remember reading a book many years ago written by someone called Leadbitter. And he actually could see thought forms, and he described them in a way that came over to me as being, I would almost say, logical, in as much that beautiful thought forms created beautiful, perfected symbols.
Mm-hmm.
But when people had ugly thoughts, there were jagged symbols, like flashes of, the way they draw lightning,
uh-huh.
Jagged bits. I thought, well, it's very interesting that your thoughts actually create these forms that seem to fit what you're thinking.
I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I've never heard of anybody else who can do the same thing, so I don't know if he was quite unique.
You know, sort of in a similar tone is that, have you seen the book My Stroke of Insight by this woman? I don't know if she's gotten to England yet, but she was She's a neuroscientist named Jill Taylor, and she was in about the age of 40. She had a stroke on the left side of her brain. So in the middle, so she knows what's going on. In the middle of the stroke, she's watching all of her brain functions shut down. You know, mm-hmm. So language and thinking and words and that kind of thing are all disappearing. She's trying to figure out how to phone for help, but she can no longer see symbols like numbers. They just look like squiggles.
Oh, yeah.
But all the while this is happening, she's discovering a sense of incredible joy and euphoria. years later, when she made sense out of this experience, her conclusion was the left hemisphere of the brain, the language hemisphere, is what creates identity, time, and story. This whole business about who you think you are and what's wrong with your life and what you should do to change and this endless chatter in the brain. But when that shuts off and you move the consciousness into the right hemisphere, you begin to feel, have feelings of unity and euphoria and joy and perfection. And she said, and I spoke with her about this, she said, heaven on earth is in the right hemisphere of the brain. And which is, makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because so many spiritual techniques are about quieting the mind, meaning the left hemisphere of the brain, so that consciousness can wake up and begin to have mystical experiences.
Yes.
So this is really kind of fun to think that we are actually hardwired for enlightenment, hardwired to find heaven on earth if we can only just quiet this left brain chatter.
Yes, yes. You've reminded me there, by saying that, about people who have out-of-the-body experiences, perhaps due to some trauma or when they're having an operation. And what you said there is reminiscent of what people often say, how they feel different, and they feel so happy and calm and peaceful.
I know people who have, you know, they were in a car accident and they're just mangled and they float up out of their body and they start feeling this incredible sense that it's okay, everything's wonderful. And then they look below and they see paramedics trying to save them. And they say, no, it's okay. I've never felt so good. This is beautiful. A lot of people don't want to go back.
No. Well, indeed, on the many reports I've read, I don't think I've hardly read of anybody who did.
Well, I think people don't want to go back to the prison of negative thought they've created. That's the thing. But if they could go back to heaven on earth, it'd be the same as going forward to heaven after earth.
Yes, indeed, you're right. Now, you spoke of something Eckhart Tolle described as a transformed state of human consciousness. Would that raise us up to another dimension of energy? I mean, would we possibly disappear from the earth and end up in the fourth dimension instead of the third? I mean, have you got any thoughts about that?
You know, I haven't really gone down that path very far. I do have a feeling, though, that as we wake up more and more, we discovered that, as the Hindu said, you know, 3,000 years ago, that only God exists and everything else is an illusion. And at the ultimate level of consciousness, we discover that we are all the one, and that we dissolve back into the one, and that the cosmos is a play of appearing and disappearing and appearing and disappearing. And
well,
that's a beautiful thing.
Yes. That fits in nicely with how I feel about it. I'm coming now to your book, Finding Heaven Here, which I mentioned at the start was obooks.com. And, of course, what we've been talking about, I guess, is largely in your book anyway. Would you like to tell us at this stage where people can buy it from, if there is any other source other than obooks? I mean, would it be available from Amazon, for example?
Oh, yes, it's available from all the major retailers and online distributors, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your local bookstore, though you might have to order it. And
right.
You get it directly from the publisher. You can also come to my website, which is johnrobinson.org, and there's a link to the book there, too, as well.
Yes. Now, originally, because we set this appointment up a little while ago, you were expecting your book to come out in March. When did it come out in the end?
You know, I think it came out in February, late
February.
Right.
Yes.
There was a delay in the printer because the printer had been changed. In any case, it was delayed by a month, but it's out. And it's doing well. It's doing quite well. I think it's, you know, people are fascinated by this possibility. What a wonderful cost-free alternative to stress and worry and depression. I mean, you don't have to pay a thing beyond the nominal charge of the book to wake up and to do this over and over again.
Right, lovely. Now, you talk about turning problems into experiences of heaven on earth. I would guess for most people that would sound rather difficult. How do you convey that idea to people in a way that they can comprehend it?
Well, the very central and most important exercise in my book is all about that. And what we learn to do is, with a process called Heaven's Compass, is to take your thoughts which are really the reason why you have the problem. You say all these things about the world and the negative fears and beliefs you have, and they cause you unhappiness. So you have to identify your thoughts, then you have to drop into your feelings and identify all the feelings that have been created by your thoughts. You know, I'm sad, I'm hopeless, I'm scared, I've got to overcome these problems, whatever stuff you've stirred up with your own thought processes. And then once you get that all out on paper, so it's kind of outside of you and you've kind of discharged it, then I teach people how to come into the presence, how to come into the experience of God's consciousness, which is an immense silence and loving, eternal here and now kind of consciousness. And in this consciousness, I begin to have them start a dialogue with the divine, whatever word they use for God. And in this dialogue, which is not hard to do, it's in the book, people learn the most amazing things about their problems. And then at the end of the dialogue, then I have them move into the direct perception of heaven on earth, which is just to start looking at the world in God's consciousness and see that the place you're in is extraordinarily beautiful and already safe and happy. And then what happens is you look back at this completed exercise and you realize that you turned these awful thoughts and the feelings they created, and they dissolved, and you look back on it and you say, why was I so upset? Why did I create this labyrinth of fear that I constantly get lost in? When instead here I am, at least for the moment, I'm awake, and I love where I am, and I love what I am, and this is it.
Right. Now, you refer to life as a spiritual journey. What do you think the goal is?
Well, I think the goal is to wake up to our own divinity here and now. To wake up to the fact that it's all divine. And I think from that place, we can't know where it goes from that, because it's, you know, the divine is unfolding these forms even as we speak. But it's a nice place, it's a good place to be.
I'm sure so, yes. You also talk of gaining the power to transform the human species and life on Earth before it is too late.
Yeah.
What do you visualize will happen if we don't sort of change our ways?
Well, you know, we've seen species extinctions before. There's, you know, we have the power to virtually destroy ourselves. I don't know that we would completely destroy ourselves, but what will happen if we destroy the structures of civilization and of farming and technology and so forth? We're going to go back several hundred years to basically subsistence economies, which may not be bad, but we're going to all be having cows and chickens and corn growing in our yard, you know, and we'd be back to that kind of basic rudimentary way of life. I'm hoping that we don't have to do that, because the cost in life, the number of people who are going to have to die, and the suffering that's going to happen is going to be immense, and it doesn't need to happen.
So there's a very powerful message here for people to wake up. That's literally what it is, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Now, you wrote an article called On the Taboo Against Knowing Where You Are. Do you think people perhaps are a little bit scared of trying to understand themselves?
Yes, I do. But I think people grow up with such fear that all they want is a simple formula for security. And so you can get that from a religion or from a, you know, point of view or a philosophy or something. But once you got it, then you just want to, like, keep it like a special prize or a good luck charm or something. And so there's a way that we short-circuit the looking anymore. But I think I really would encourage people to not be afraid to look at themselves, look at their feelings, look at the world, because you'll discover so much that's amazing. And once you begin to have faith in the unfolding nature of divinity, the presence of God as what is, you begin to say, it's okay, you know, I don't have to fix everything, I don't have to improve myself, I'm already good enough, I'm already perfect, and I love you. Then we live in a different kind of world. The world we create with the mind, it's just got us running terrified.
Yes. Does it come down to really having faith in some intelligence that seems to be seems to have created the order and perfection in things?
Yeah. What we do as human beings through every sort of era and generation is we create images of the divine, and they represent projections of our own nature. So the Old Testament, God is a wrathful, angry guy riding in on horseback, just like the fierce warriors of that time. But yes. As we wake up and as we settle down, we realize that God is none of these things, that you cannot, you know, hold God in a concept. And that's such a relief, because then what is the divine unfolding as our own being, as our own consciousness.
Yes, indeed. Well, as I've often heard people say, that in the Bible it says that man was made in God's image, but in fact man tries to make God in his image.
Precisely, yeah. And then gets scared of the image he makes.
Yes. Right. Now, you wrote another article called Living the Myth of Inanna, or Inanna.
Uh-huh.
Is that by any chance one of the Sumerian gods?
Yes, it is. That's an ancient Sumerian myth about the journey to the underworld.
Can you briefly tell us what that was about then?
Well, what that was about for me was that, I don't know if we have time, but several years ago I had an episode of atrial fibrillation, you know, where your heart starts racing and you have to be kind of defibrillated with a shock to the chest.
Really?
So I was in the emergency room, and this happened to me, and I got the shock to the chest, but it triggered body memories of open heart surgery that I had as a boy. And so I began, you know, the body remembers everything, and so I began to literally experience the heart surgery going on in my body, because it turns out I had awakened in the surgery as a child, and had, you know, it was such a catastrophic experience, I cut it off. I used the myth of Inanna to describe that descent into the underworld, where I had to basically go down into the depths of my own unconscious, of my own psyche, and recover this person who had been, you know, basically murdered and impaled on a stake, which is the way the myth goes, and bring him back to life and bring him back into the world. And that's what the myth of Inanna is all about. It's really the myth of a goddess going to the underworld and having to heal the world and restore the world to its beauty again by recovering the death at the bottom, by facing the death at the bottom of this circle.
Mm. All right. I'm glad my memory served me well there, because
yeah.
The Sumerian period, I find a very interesting part of our ancient history.
It's very much like the myth of Persephone. It's a kind of a version of like that.
Yes. Would you go as far to say that man's ultimate destination, or humanity's ultimate destination, is a great journey that actually leads them back to God, whatever they believe that is?
Yes, yeah. But not as a belief, but as a lived experience, as what is.
Right. Now, why would ordinary people, as you might call them, the run-of-the-mill type, be interested in your book? I mean, why should they be?
Well, first of all, like I said, it's a cost-free alternative to the stress of everyday life, you know, especially in these hard economic times. It's also a spirituality that's infinitely hopeful and optimistic and liberating. I mean, it says you don't have to get better, you don't have to improve everything around you, you just have to wake up and see where you really are. And finally, it's got practices in it that allow us to turn problems into experiences of heaven on earth. And so, in effect, having a problem is a good reminder to say, whoa, wait a minute. If I'm growing crazy with this problem, feeling angry or hurt or depressed, that means I've left the kingdom. I'm outside the garden, and I need to find my way back. So every problem can be a stimulus for coming home again to Eden, to creation.
Yes. Well, that's interesting. We haven't quite got to the end of the program yet, but time is passing by so quickly. Yes, it has been very interesting. We're reaching, let me see, I'm looking at my clock here. We've probably got about another 4 minutes or so, and I want to give you time to mention your email address. And, of course, you have a free, what is it? Free newsletter or something of that nature. I'm trying to find my notes here now about that one.
No, I'm still working on that. I haven't got that yet, but you can go to my website, which is www.johnrobinson.com,
mm-hmm.
And there's some video clips of me giving a talk. And actually, I've been playing the guitar for years, and I started writing music about heaven on earth, and so I'm singing a song on my website about that, which is kind of
fun. Right, yeah.
And there's a way to contact me at the website, too, so if you want to send me a message or ask me a question, I love to get the emails, and I love to answer them.
Right. You can give out your email address, then.
Yep, you can give it. You can also have it directly, which is jcr416@aol.com.
Yes. Right.
You just make sure you put in the subject line, you know, that I heard you on this station or something, so I'll kind of know it's not spam.
Okay. I will put that in the archive report when it's time to go in, but I'll repeat your email address because I know if somebody's trying to write it down, they probably can't keep up with it. But it's jcr416@aol.com. I know what it was I was trying to think that you had, but I thought for a moment it was something else. It is that people can be included on your mailing list with questions and comments. That's what I was trying to get at.
Oh, sure. If you want to be on my mailing list, just send me in your name and I'll put you on it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
We are almost getting to the end of the program. Have you got any particular message you would like to convey to people before we close?
Well, you know, people often say, well, how could there be heaven on earth, you know, when there's so much suffering and evil in the world and all these bad things that are happening? And I just want to say that the moment we fall into that argument, we talk ourselves out of the very place that we want to go to and live in right now. The very fact that people do bad things doesn't mean heaven's not here. It just means that they're so caught up in their own pain and negativity and awful belief systems that they act in ways that are destructive. Human cruelty will end when we finally know where we are. Heaven on earth is here now, and when we discover that, everything will change.
I agree entirely with you there. I'm just looking to see now if I have any final questions. I think I've almost got to the end of my list now. I'm looking at some of your articles here. Well, you talk about living every day in heaven on earth. I guess we're really coming back to this question of unconditional love, are we not?
Well, it also has to do with how do we do it on a moment-to-moment basis. You know, you might be in a very happy place, and then you get a crummy phone call or your husband yells at you or, you know, something happens. How do you come back to heaven on earth rather than spin out and spend the rest of the day miserable with full of angry thoughts? It's really how do we live moment-to-moment in the consciousness of the divine, in the presence.
Yes. And indeed, I think when you can achieve a level like that, people notice perhaps how calm and how peaceful you are, and I think you help to create that in other people as well.
Oh yes, it's attractive and it's contagious.
They might even want to know what your secret is, and you tell them to buy your book.
There you go.
Well, it's been very nice to have you on. It's been very, very interesting. You certainly have a lot of knowledge there, and you've applied it very nicely to your particular interest. So thank you very much for coming on.
Well, Meg, thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Great, yes. So I've got a couple of minutes left to quickly announce next week's program. So thank you very much. God bless you, my friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Right, that was John Robinson, and I'm sure you listened in with great interest what he had to speak about. My guest next week will be Carla Rooker McCarty. She's a Christian mystic and librarian by training who formed a partnership in 1968 with Don Elkins, a physics professor and commercial airline pilot. And they began a serious and systematic investigation into the UFO phenomenon. She has written a book called The Wanderer's Handbook and others, so obviously our program will be discussing that, which is one of my favourite subjects. So I'm sure you enjoy today's program, and I hope you can be with me next week. Thank you very much. God bless you all.